Peter R. Breggin, M.D., is called the conscience of psychiatry for his many decades of successful reform efforts. His scientific and educational work provide the foundation for modern criticism of drugs and ECT and lead the way in promoting more caring and effective therapies. His books include Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, Medication Madness, Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, and now, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety, Understanding and Overcoming Negative Emotions. Welcome to the Dr. Peter Breggin Hour.
Hi, folks. My wonderful, wonderful audience. I'm really, really glad to be visiting with all of you again. It's spring becoming summer up in Ithaca, New York. And I've been looking out my window and walking about and enjoying the birds. We're turning about an acre backyard into a bird sanctuary with all kinds of feeders and baths. I have a bath in, even though there's a creek and a little pond, but they actually feel safer sometimes, the birds coming up to a bath up on a deck rather than having to sort of crouch around down by the water wondering what's going to spring at them. And it's just really beautiful out. Saw a grosbeak on my feeder. I haven't seen that in a long time. Beautiful bird that's black and white and it's got a bib around its neck and its upper chest is a beautiful red color. And we have, red-winged blackbirds coming to our feeder. I think they live around the creek and the pond. And I've never seen red-winged blackbirds at a feeder, and most of my friends haven't seen them at their backyard feeders. So we're doing a good job of providing a sanctuary, and we got the usual squirrels and chipmunks and occasional deer come by on that wooded hill beyond the property. It's beautiful out. I hope you're enjoying nature. I hope you're enjoying life. And I hope you feel like you're doing good in the universe, which is always a really important feeling to have. Doing good in the universe, and being good to your friends and your neighbors, and just reaching out to folks. It isn't something that those of us who get inside our heads too much think about enough, about just how important it is to be there for other people. And, of course, to have them there for us. So my great audience, there's a little encouragement. If you're a little stuck inside yourself today, get out in the nature. Be with a person. Watch a bird. Be grateful. It's impossible to be grateful and to be desperate at the same time. Great message, important message. Don't forget my website, my frequent alerts. My most recent one is What's Really the Matter with Your Child? That your doctor probably missed this. It's a great blog that I encouraged and helped get up on the Mad in America. I put up my last radio show, actually my April 25th radio show, on my frequent alert, which I don't always do. I probably should always put up what it's about. And it was a good show about human relationships. And then my alert before that is your, quote, your pharmacist is tattling on you. Because I got a notice from my pharmacist. It wasn't actually my pharmacist, my patient's pharmacist, but it's a few miles away from Ithaca. And the note was that my patient didn't renew their medicine, their medication for an antipsychotic drug. And the reason my patient didn't go and renew that is because they were now off of their antipsychotic drug. But imagine that your pharmacist is tattling on you. If I was a different kind of doctor, I mean, I could have, gotten that notice and called my patient, or have my nurse call my patient, or have my assistant to my nurse call the patient and say, you're not taking your medicine. Goodness, tattling, pharmacist tattling. I'm looking forward to today. Jeannie, are you there?
I'm here.
And you sound good and clear, and you sound cheery. I thought
I'm
this was
cheery
a cheering up day. what, Jeannie? You're snorkeling.
I'm so happy to be here with you.
You and I snorkel together.
We do. We snort, and we have fun.
Well, let me tell you about Jeannie. I'm going to actually read you something off Jeannie's website about herself. I usually just give a quick summary. Jeannie's been on the show a number of times before. So here's her interests. She listed them. Dr. Stolzers, S-T-O-L-Z-E-R-S, Stolzers, Jeannie with an N-E at the end. Dr. Stolzer's research interests include the biocultural aspects of breastfeeding, attachment parenting, co-sleeping. That's about parents and children and younger children. Ethology, I'll let her explain that to you. Biogenetics, now a lot of this she's critical of. Evolutionary mothering, that she's positive in. Attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, that she's critical of. The mass labeling and drugging of children and adolescents. Evolutionary biogenetics, neurobiology. I'm not even sure exactly what her take is on some of those, though I know her so well. And the effects of psychotropic drugs. I know what her thinking is on that. Jeannie got her PhD at the University of Nebraska way back in 2002. I've spoken at the university where she's now a full professor at the University of Nebraska in Kearney, Nebraska. I never say it right, G. Do you say Kearney or Kearney, Nebraska?
How about Kearney?
Kearney. Gee, my God. Kearney, Nebraska. she teaches child and adolescent development, stuff like that. And every year she lets her students decide for themselves what their project is going to be. And periodically they do something like pick at the local mental health facility. I don't know what she's been doing lately. This is going to be an open-ended, wonderful conversation with my dear friend Jeannie. And we're going to talk about relationships and mothering and goodness knows what else, and maybe about her class and what her students do just being invited to do what they want. Of course, they've been in her course, so they can figure out what might make Jeannie happy, but I mean, that's okay too. Hi, Jeannie, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I just am so glad to be with you. I know I've told you this 100 times, but I'll tell you 100 more. You have been so influential in my work, and I just thank you so much for what you're putting out there in the universe and for all of the great work you're doing. I can't thank you enough.
God bless you for that. Let me say something about that to the folks. I'm going to say something you almost never hear me say. Jeannie has been very influential in my work and my thinking. You know, I once jokingly, Jeannie asked, you know, who had influenced me. And I said to her, well, God, I've been Peter Bregan for a long time now, which I hope I'm entitled to do now that I'm an elderly gentleman, or at least an elder one. I don't think I'm elderly. But actually, Jeannie has had a very big influence on me. I had kind of forgotten some of my roots in attachment theory. It's not even a theory. Attachment, understanding human relations as profound attachments, going back to the work of Bowlby in Great Britain, who was a psychoanalyst, but not your Freudian, internalized, creepy, sexually oriented member of a cult Freudian psychoanalyst, but a really caring, involved, engaged person who brought other people around him, this Bowlby, and started looking at what really goes on between parents and children, what goes on in Great Britain during the bombing. Are kids better off in London during a bombing or with their parents, their mother, or little children? Are they better off in the peace of the countryside? Well, folks, they're better off with their mothers in the bombing in London. So it's just stuff that struck me, and I kind of let it go a bit. And Jeannie reminded me about that, and I bought some more of his books. I found a couple I had, and I just think his influence has been really good. And Jeannie's influence on me, not channeling Bowlby, but in whole new ways of thinking about breastfeeding and parent-child relationships. I'm very grateful to Jeannie for that. So take that, my friend. And where do we go from here? I want to give you some freedom here to just be Jeannie Stolzer.
Well, I think that our political correct culture that we've constructed has really, really, really moved us away from a basic science postulate, and that is that young mammals absolutely need their mother or a permanent mother substitute if optimal development is to occur. And we've just buried that basic scientific postulate because our cultural scripts don't support that. So it's, Bowlby has influenced hugely. So have the ethologists Goodall and Lorenz. But if you look at human beings, for example, for 99.9999% of our time on this planet, we have been mothering in very, very specific ways. Exclusive from breastfeeding, co-sleeping, staying in close physical proximity to our young throughout the formative years, non-drugged births, all of these things have been an esoteric part of mammalian parenting since the Mesozoic era, when the first shrew-like mammals appeared on our planet. This is our bioevolutionary heritage, and in Western cultures, modern Western cultures, we've sort of just swept it under the rug and pretended like we're not mammals. And right now, we're living with the consequences of those choices.
God, that is so important, Jeannie. I wrote down, I don't know if I got it right, 99.9999% of our time developing as shrew-like animals, which is actually how I open my book, Guilt, Shame, and Anxiety. And I think I got it from you. I don't think you got it from me. Or maybe we went back and forth to begin thinking that way. It's so important. Think about this. Think about this, my friends. Think about this. If we look at how did we evolve over 99.9999% of our existence on Earth, how did we develop? How did we live during that evolution? What did we eat? How did we have sex? How did we hang out with our families, or did we, or didn't we? And we start asking all about that. And of course, mammals have gone in different directions. We didn't go in the directions of, even at the last minute, of orangutans. We went in the directions of chimpanzees. And just think about what it all means for you and me. Are we happy living the way we're living now? Is it consistent enough with how we have always lived? So I just think this is so important. I think it just can't be underestimated. And it's more and more been influencing me, even to my thinking about deprofessionalizing the whole area of talking therapy, so-called therapy, and starting to think about how do people help each other? How have we always helped each other? What do we give each other? Anyhow, just asking those questions in that context. Back to you, Jeannie.
Well, I'm glad you brought up, you know, what we used to eat, because if you think about humans, we're just talking about humans now. We don't get our molars, our permanent molars, till we're about between 5 and 7 years old. So we have the technology right now. I cannot believe I lived long enough to actually witness this. We have the technology right now. If we have enough bone marrow, we can extract the bone marrow, and we can tell you exactly how long that human was breastfed, had human milk, and exactly to the month when their first foods were introduced. We can do it. Isn't that crazy? I mean,
that is crazy, and I didn't know that. Wow.
Absolutely, we can do it. So what we know is that our ancient ancestors, and of course, this data is coming from the Middle East, Levant, Mesopotamia, parts of Egypt, Syria, current-day Israel. Our ancestors, 3, 4, 5,000 years ago, were breastfed on average 3 to 5 years, and they had their first solid foods around 14 to 16 months. They didn't have their basic diets were human milk, because if you think of the foods that were available at that time, they were raw nuts and, you know, jerky typed meat, and we didn't have like SpaghettiOs. the foods we had required molars, you know, to chew. So we were living very, very different. But what our ancient ancestors couldn't have known is that the brain doesn't fully develop. I'm talking about in weight and mass until about 5 to 7 years of age. So you're getting your mother's milk, making sure you have all that synaptic connection, all the molecular structure needed for proper neurological development. They couldn't have known either that our immune systems as humans are not fully functional in a human being until 4 to 6 years of age. So they had their mother's antibodies from their milk that were keeping them healthy and vibrantly alive, because their little immune systems aren't able to do it. They couldn't have known that. They just knew that they had to nurse for a long time if they wanted healthy children. And when you compare that to America today, I mean, it's unrecognizable. Our average weaning rate in this country is 6 weeks right now. It's non-hominid is what it is. It's non-human. That's not the way we mother. But over the last 100 years, there's been a profound change in our mothering.
Can you say why you pick 100 years? What was the big change?
Well, what the big change was is when the pharmaceutical companies started buying up the formula industry. Most people don't know this, but the same people that manufacture Prozac is the same industry that manufactures baby formula. It's the pharmaceutical industry. So they bought it up, and they promoted it, and they promoted it slick and in a clever, clever manner. They made us believe in around 1914, 1916, that this was the most high-tech way to feed a baby, and it was the most healthy way to feed a baby. They lied through their teeth. And most Americans couldn't afford their product. So we had breastfeeding rates around that time, turn of the century, 1915, at about 95%, with weaning occurring between 2 and 4 years of age. That was our... And then something happens with the World War that really changes our destiny in this Western society that we've built, and that is men go across the ocean to fight and women go into factories in the early 40s, and our breastfeeding rates plummet to about 4.5 to 5%. And you would think that in the 50s, when the men come home and the women move out of the factories, that our breastfeeding rates would go up again, but just exactly the opposite happens, and now they plummet to their lowest ever. About 97% of Americans were feeding their babies formula. Again, based on lies, scientific lies, outright lies.
Well, Jeannie, when you say 97% were feeding, you don't mean that only 3% gave any milk? It must have been a cutoff age?
No, I mean 3%. In 1955 in America, 3% of American children were breastfed from their mother's breast.
At all?
That's all.
Oh, my Lord. I had no idea. What's the number now?
Well, it's really hard for researchers like me, because right now our government data is considering any nursing as nursing. So we go through hospitals and we say, did you nurse your baby? And if you nursed your baby once for 13 seconds, you're considered a breastfeeder. So if taking that kind of data, and by the way, breastfeeding is not a categorical variable. It's not yes or no. It's a continuous variable based on duration and frequency and all those things that we know, but they don't calculate like that. So right now we've got about 55% are saying that they're nursing at least once. And by 6 months, we've got about 95% weaned. So 5% of us are nursing after 6 months.
Yeah, I'm really sure it's no bigger than that. Yeah.
Really dismal. But then when you look at our policies, you really can't put this all on the backs of women. You know, we're one of four countries who doesn't offer paid maternity leave. It would be us and Lesotho and Swaziland and Papua New Guinea. Those would be the four countries in the United States of America that don't offer women paid maternity leave to nurse their babies. We're the only country on the planet that offers, I shouldn't say offers, that gives low-income women free formula. And the taxpayers pay for that. You pay for that, and I pay for that if you have a job. And then you also pay for their quadrupled rates of hospitalization and their quadrupled rates of seeing the doctor, because these are low-income people who are on Medicaid. Other countries provide paid maternity leave, so they don't have those crazy medical bills for their low-income people.
That's amazing. I don't want to skip over that providing paid maternity leave allows a vastly increased rate, you're saying, of nursing. And that nursing results in a vastly more healthy population of infants and young children. And it's actually probably even good for the economy, although not everything has to be good for the economy. Am I summarizing right there?
That's good. And it's important to, okay, let me say two things. Number one, this isn't my research. This is the Surgeon General of the United States of America. According to the Surgeon General of the United States of America, if American women would breastfeed for 6 months exclusively, just 6 months, we would save $3.5 billion, that's with a B, billion dollars a year in health care costs alone. If we would just nurse for 12 months exclusively, just 12 months, we would save $7 billion a year in health care costs. That's how the Norwegian country, Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Finland, Austria, Italy, Israel are all paying for health care. It's not on the backs of their citizens. It's in savings in health care. And people believe this health care is only for children. It's not. It's through their life course. And it's for mothers. Mothers who nurse long-term are significantly less likely to get diabetes, many types of cancer, osteoporosis, depression, anxiety, all mood disorders, rheumatoid arthritis, the list goes on and on and on. It's not only helping kids, it's helping women.
What do you think the mechanism of that is? Kind of an awful word to use at this point. But why do you think that nursing women do so much better in so many ways?
It's a physiological interdependence. We know that nature or God or evolution, whatever your particular theory is that started all of this, they are physiologically interdependent on one another for optimal health outcomes. She's helping that baby throughout life to be the healthiest individual it can be until it dies. But that baby is also, she's a mammal. She's a female mammal. And her hormones are dependent on having children and nursing them long term. That's her natural state. And I know feminists hate me for talking like this, but it's simply a biological fact. Facts don't cease to exist because you don't like them. If squirrels decided tomorrow to stop nursing, we would see a huge increase, not only in their death rates of their babies and their morbidity rates of their children, but you'd see female squirrels, all types of different types of cancer, particularly breast, endometrial, uterine, those types of cancers would go through the roof. But you don't see that because they're mammals, and they do what they were bioevolutionarily programmed to do.
Well, I'm so glad to have you going into depth on this. And I'd like to just stay with this. It just always, you know, blows me away when I hear you talking, and it's about these issues. And it's like it's almost too painful to listen to. So don't stop listening, folks. I think I'll check the listenership here and see how it's doing. Don't go away. Don't go away. Stay with it. No, we're not going to fix all this overnight. We're not going to figure out how to how to, you know, keep providing women all the freedom that they need and deserve as individual human beings, just like the male of the species. But we got to look at the natural facts, the natural truths about human life.
And what we have to start doing, what we have to start doing immediately is demanding, not asking, but demanding that physicians, particularly those physicians who work with women, pediatricians, OBGYNs, family practitioners, that physicians are required by national law to be highly trained in breastfeeding and they have to have ongoing training. Some of my work, and I'm definitely not the top scholar in this field, it's Freed, Dr. Freed, F-R-E-E-D, that's the top scholar here, but he has clearly and unequivocally stated, because he's got the data to back himself up, that physicians educated in America don't have training in human lactation. So you can blame women about this if you want to, but that's ludicrous. Women, they've lost their role models because no one's breastfeeding, so they don't know who to go to. So they're not making enough milk, say. So they go to their physician, you know, the expert, who has no more training in lactation than I have training in nuclear fission. So they're getting erroneous information from the medical establishment. We've got to stop this. I mean, we have the highest infant mortality rate in the industrialized world. No one can touch us. The richest, most educated culture that's ever existed on the planet has the highest infant mortality rate in the industrialized world. What is going on?
Well, you seem to be, are you there, Jeannie? I feel like I lost
I'm here.
You. Good. You're breaking
can
up
you hear me?
A little. Yeah, but you're breaking up a little. Are you on a cell?
No, I'm not on a cell.
All right. Well, you're back, too. Jeannie, this is just so startling because we hear this all the time. Our infant mortality rate is high, and it never comes out. Never does anybody ever attach it to when we're not nursing our infants. I don't think I've ever seen that on PBS or any other place that might talk about infant mortality. They always talk about we need them. We need national health insurance and things like that. But they don't talk about, well, we need a societal change. We need to bring up our children like we did for 99.9999% of our mammalian existence. We need to nurse
them. That's
right.
And we
Jeannie,
need to,
go ahead.
What we need to do is quit dichotomizing the public and private spheres. I mean, this isn't about working women. It's really not. Women have worked. The first woman was on this planet. The difference between today and then was the woman had to strap her baby on her and go out in the fields gathering and doing what she did, weaving. She didn't get to quit being a mother because she still had to work if her family was going to survive. So what we've done in modern-day America, we've sort of created this dichotomy that, you know, the private sphere is where you mother and breastfeed and nurture and guide, and the public sphere is where you're a lawyer and a professor and a restaurant owner, and the two can never mix. That's ridiculous. Of course we can be mothers and workers simultaneously. We've been doing it for millions of years. It's this culture that refuses to allow it to happen. So it's not about working mother. I've been criticized. Well, what do you want? Women to be, you know, pregnant and barefooted and like they were in the past? No.
Well, it's especially not true now because we can do so much work from home.
Exactly. Exactly. Mm. What's so important about this whole topic is little kids are little for such a short time. Anybody that's raised my son is 26 years old now, and it flew by. I can't believe he's 26. His infancy was such a short time in his toddlerhood, his early childhood, and then he was off and running, you know, in the world.
Right. But of course, Jeannie, people are going to have 2, 3, 4 children or more, And that changes that scenario a lot in terms
I'm so
of
glad you brought
how are
it
we
up.
going to have big, healthy families.
I'm so very glad you brought this up. And please, please look this up. Don't, I mean, I've been publishing in this area for at least 2 decades, but it is a scientific fact that when you breastfeed like a primordial woman, or like women right now in vast parts of Asia and Africa, you don't ovulate. So you're not going to have 8 and 10 and 12 children like my Irish ancestors did. It's not going to happen. We found this out, actually. Kloss and Kennel found this tribe in Africa named the Kung. It's spelled very oddly with an exclamation point, and then it's K-U-N-G. Look up this research. It is absolutely riveting. They found this great big tribe in Africa, and they were having babies every 5 to 8 years. And they thought, wow. You know, of course, they don't have pills. They don't have any patches. They don't have any condoms. So our American mind, you know, in our Western mind, we said, well, they probably have sexual taboos, that they don't have sex very often. Well, that quickly went down the drain after observation. They were having sex on average 7 times a week. So that was out. So then they started looking at their breastfeeding behaviors. These women were breastfeeding almost constantly. They had babies wrapped around them. And if their 4 or 5-year-old who was out in the field with them wanted to nurse too, they would get up on mother and nurse too. So you can't ovulate when you're nursing like that. Now, if you nurse like an American, you're going to get your period back in 6 weeks. There's no doubt about it. What I mean by nurse like an American is by the clock, you know, every 4 hours, the baby's at daycare. They're in a crib during the night, so they're not nursing all through the night. They have pacifiers stuck in their mouth to meet their suckling needs. When all of these things are done, then we, you know, we have babies every 10, 12 months. We weren't, that's not our bioevolutionary heritage. A woman's not supposed to have 15 babies. It's not good for her.
Right. And it couldn't have happened in older times, I would think. Now, this is the one area that where I've been kind of been won around by you into the need for government intervention that would be quite massive in our lives, because there's no way I can see women being in our current economy, the kind of modern economy we have, returning to breastfeeding on a regular basis and enjoying motherhood if they weren't in some way supported by the government. It's just the way the communities are now. We don't have extended communities where we can support each other and look out for each other, and where the hunter comes back and actually, after feeding his own family, makes sure everybody in the tribe who's needy gets it. Not in the tribe. Tribe's too big. But in the extended families where we were 99.99999%, whatever, you know. So I do believe that. Now, I remember Trump's daughter had been talking about that. Do you have any idea politically whatever happened to that?
I don't, but I was so excited when Ivanka brought that up. And then I heard President Trump say it out of his own mouth during the State of the Union address, but he only said one sentence. So, you know, I was sitting here like, oh, my God, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. But I don't know politically what's happening, but I know we are so overdue. But we don't just need to change policy. We've got to change our minds, because right now we value the worker over the mother. I mean, watch women, you know, and women can blame men for a lot. I mean, and they do blame men for a lot. But this one, they can't blame men for. When women get together at a party or at the library, they inevitably say to one another, what do you do? And when she says, I'm an orthodontist, they all, you know, gather around and say, that is so fabulous. Tell us. But when she says, I raise my 2 children, then she's treated like a non-person, like, you know, you're not going to do anything with your life. So we've got to stop this valuing the worker over the mother and basing a woman's worth. I mean, her actual worth as a human on the letters behind her name and her bank account. It's because none of those things are going to be there when you take your last breath. When you're an elderly old woman, you know, struggling to breathe, is your PhD going to be there kissing your forehead, or your bank account going to be there holding your hand? No. We're putting all our eggs in a basket that just, it doesn't even matter. It's all an illusion.
Oh, boy. This is going to be interesting. This would be an interesting show. Maybe come back and open it up to questions. I just haven't, you know, for years now, I haven't taken questions because mostly I think I'd be asked about drugs and medications and personal issues and so on. And also my guests are so interesting. I never feel like I need to fill in 20 minutes or half an hour, never, of an interview. I mean, I could fill it in myself if I had to. And so I don't worry about the guests in that way either. But this is so controversial. This is so life-changing. This is so incredibly important. I had a professor back in med school, and that was in the 60s, who was a very nice man. And I'll never forget him saying that no woman has to, he was an OBGYN in the 60s. Mm-hmm. No woman has to nurse. We have everything in formulas now that infants need.
I bet he
was just, representing the interests of these giant pharmaceutical companies and not even maybe knowing it. Because I remember thinking at the time, I was maybe second year medical student, I'm thinking at the time, well, how the heck can he know that, number one? I mean, can he see, do we detect all the antibodies? Do we detect all this and all that that's going on in milk? Are there things in there we never even heard of before and haven't identified? And I don't know that I actually at that point in time thought, and what about the nurturing?
But one of the things I want to say about what you just said is that the pharmaceutical industry did researchers like me the biggest favor they could have ever done, because they're almost $1 trillion a year industry, almost. It'll tip in the next 5 or 6 years. But they took 60,000 women. I mean, can you imagine how much this cost to do this? 60,000 women. They analyzed 60,000 samples of human milk. And why did they do that and spend the money? Because their goal was to replicate human milk in the laboratory. So they get these 60,000 samples. They nearly go out of their minds because all 60,000 were completely different compositionally.
Yes.
And then they nearly went out of their minds again because in an hour and a half, they did the exact same thing. And now, not only were they different from one another, the woman's was different than it was an hour and a half ago. It is continually changing. It's this dynamic substance. The antibody content changes. It can never be replicated in a laboratory because it's based on the needs of a baby and the environmental factors in the woman's immediate environment. That's what's determining what antibodies she's secreting. Does she need to secrete antibodies for strep throat? Or does she need to secrete antibodies for leukemia? What does she need to do? And the pharmaceutical industry will never do that.
That is an amazing description, Janie. An amazing. Folks who are listening to this, I hope you'll take it all in and for me, it's been gradual. It's like I've heard Jeannie many times, and I just keep getting more and more reinforced in understanding this and how critical this is. Every mother is raising a child. Is on a diet that the child is influenced by. As the child begins to eat, they'll be eating in response to things they've tasted in mother's milk. I've read studies about how what the mother eats influences the appetite of children, of infants, after they start eating later on. Have you heard that, Jeannie?
Yes, and it clearly influences obesity rates, because when you think about this, a nursling, whether it's a nursling kitten or a nursling llama or a nursling human, they nurse until they're full. And with the doctors will tell you she needs to drink 7 ounces every 5 hours. So you've seen mothers yourself with the bottle, you know, going, just one more ounce, you know, and the formula's seeping out of the side of the mouth, and you've got this great big rotund fat baby. What are we doing? Babies nurse until they're full. That's it. And nobody knows why it drives people crazy. Nobody knows if that baby just drank 37 ounces or three. All we know is she drank until she was full. So,
you know, I doubt if I got nursed at all. I know that my parents, my mother brought in a youngster to sort of take care of me at a very, very early age. I mean, maybe at birth practically. And I doubt very much that she nursed me at all. And maybe she was told she couldn't or something, you know. I know that happened to your mother.
Yes.
But I had a weight issue my entire life. When I was running track, I was the short, fat little kid who was winning. If I'd been 40 pounds less, I would have won more. And I think that it's only now that I probably don't have a weight problem as of maybe these last few months, because, you know, in April of last year, I went on a plant-based diet and stopped all cow nursing. I stopped eating cheese. I stopped being nursed by cows. I stopped eating cheese and all dairy products, which is essentially nursing me as an adult. I've never heard this before. On cow's milk. I think that's exactly right. I was being nursed, like so many Americans, on cow's milk into our elder years. And that change of diet for me has made being I'm like 35 pounds less than I was last April. So, I mean, all of these things play into each other. They're so important. If you want to think about what is holistic medicine, you're listening to it today. It is not taking a supplement. That is not holistic medicine.
It's not
sending off your hair for an evaluation. It's getting down to the basics of eating as we were evolved to eat. And
yes,
relating to each other, starting with nursing, and starting in the womb, with
starting
how
in
we
the womb.
Feel about being parents. That's holistic medicine, folks. We're at the essence of holistic medicine right now.
Goes back to sort of your roots about the psychiatric drugs. I want all of your listeners to look up two nanopeptide hormones called oxytocin and prolactin. When you're nursing, you're secreting large levels of these nanopeptide hormones, and how much you actually produce in the bloodstream, and yes, they can be measured. This isn't theoretical. They can be measured in your bloodstream. How much you produce of oxytocin and prolactin is dependent on the frequency, duration, and intensity of your breastfeeding behaviors, and these are actually called the love hormones in the medical literature. They're called the love hormones because they induce feelings of peace and bliss and this all-encompassing love and this urge to stay in close physical proximity with your young. We are supposed to be secreting these hormones, and this is why breastfeeding mammals, including the cougar and the horse and the cat and the human and the chimp, they don't get postpartum depression or anxiety or panic attacks or mood disorders. They're flooded with these love hormones. We're not supposed to be depressed when we have a baby. So God or nature or evolution, whatever you think it is, put this mechanism in place. Nurse a lot, and look at the oxytocin and the prolactin. Look how happy you are. It's amazing. It's simply amazing. And it had to be that way, because if it wasn't, the mammalian species would have went extinct because when you're depressed, you don't care for your babies the way they need to be cared for.
Has there been a study of postpartum depression in terms of nursing?
Absolutely, and I published some of them.
Oh, my yes. God. Tell us a lot about them.
Well, it's just that simple, that postpartum depression is not normative in the mammalian species. And when we have comparison groups of those flooded with oxytocin and prolactin compared to those who don't, i.e. the formula feeders, we see amazingly high rates of depression and anxiety and mood disorders in the non-lactating females. I mean, it's clear. It's absolutely clear. But when we have physicians who aren't trained in this area, they're not telling their patients about this. I mean, honest to God, if you are in Walmart and look at all the women who are feeding their babies bottles of formula, do you think they know what we're talking about today? Of course they don't, because their physicians are uneducated in this area and they're not telling them. So as far as that woman in Walmart is concerned, it's about the same as picking a pink or a yellow blanket. It's just a choice, formula or breastfeeding, and nothing could be further from the truth. We're talking about women and children's mortality and morbidity rates throughout the life course.
Wow. This is so important. By the way, I'm picking up a squeaking. Are you turning in your chair, having a good time rocking?
I was turning in my chair.
I just can see you there doing it. I don't know if anybody else has noticed it, but all of a sudden I'm hearing it, and it sounds just like me squeaking in a chair. I have to learn to sit so still in front of the microphone and the camera and so on and so forth. This is I just think you are cutting down to just the essence here of something so incredibly important, but so hard to listen to. So folks, you know, stay with us and listen and think about the implications of this. To some extent, humanity's success will be determined by this. We can't be the same. We can't have the same degree of personal and emotional success, I don't think, without taking seriously everything, every word that's being talked about today by Jeannie Stolzer. And again, you can find Jeannie on the internet. It's not hard. Stolzer, and Jeannie is Jeannie. Jeannie, how do your students in college, where you're looking at women who are in greater numbers now than boys, and it was so striking sitting in your cafeteria. It was actually the first time I realized how bad it was. And I said, where are all the men? And you said, well, no, this is about the proportion, this way lopsided absence of men. She said, you said, this is how it is throughout America increasingly. And how do the men and women in your class, when you talk about these issues, how do they respond?
Like deer in headlights. I mean, it's just like they cannot even believe what they're hearing. And of course, because I'm a professor and I have it up on the board every single day of my life, because I teach Monday through Friday, the differentiation between fact, theory, and opinion, I have all of the scientifically published literature, peer-reviewed literature, available so they can look at it, because I don't teach, you know, about opinions. I don't believe in it. That's not what I'm paid to do. So they're just absolutely mesmerized, and it's incredible. I mean, but I have to tell you this, one of the greatest things, because I'm getting old now, I have all these baby pictures in my office of all these babies, because moms will come to me, my students, my ex-students that have these babies. They've been breastfed long-term, and it's just this most warming thing to know that I'm making this kind of difference and that they're changing these kids' trajectories of their lives. But I got to say this before I forget. My work, my life's work, is not about blaming women. All of us, including me, did the very best we could with the information we had at the time. So that's so critically important. No mother, father can blame themselves for making choices that they thought were the best at the time. That's not what this is. But we have different information now. We have different scientific information, so we can change how others are doing things. It doesn't have to be about, you know, guilt, shame, and anxiety. How was that for a plug for your book?
Good for you. Well, 23 years ago, when your son was born, what were you thinking at the time, and what did you do? Might help people to know where you're coming from.
I usually don't talk about personal experiences, but I will say this. I was the luckiest human being on the planet when I had my baby. The doctors told me to nurse every 5 to 6 hours for 5 minutes on each breast. I didn't know anybody who ever nursed. All I knew in my head that it was better than formula. That's how what I knew. So I did what the doctor said, and I was in so much pain. And a mother, one of my friends, her name was Lynn McCleary at the time, I'll say it, because she saved my life, walked in, looked at me, and said, "What are you doing?" Because I was in so much pain. I was so engorged. I didn't know what the heck I was doing. She said, "We're going to go in the shower. We've got to get you nursing." I said, "No, it hasn't been 5 hours yet." She said, "That's crazy. We're going to nurse right now. This is a little baby. He needs to nurse over and over." So because my friend that has no medical degree came in, she saved me. She did. And I will be forever, ever grateful to her, because it turned my whole... I didn't know you could just... You mean nurse like whenever they want to? I mean, that's crazy. And she said,
"Yeah, geez." I mean, and it's so nuts when the mostly men and these researchers and doctors come and start putting onto a schedule something that could never have been scheduled over 99.9999% of our mammalian existence. We didn't even have clocks, and we couldn't count past a few numbers, if at all.
So she said to me, "You've had kittens in your house, right? Didn't you have a mother cat that had kittens?" And I said, "Yes." And she said, "Jeannie, she doesn't wear a watch. She's not listening to the vet. She just nurses when they want to nurse." And she said, "Watch them through the night. They nurse almost continuously when they're newborns." And they do, because our milk is 100% digestible. So, and that's what I learned from Dr. Jane Goodall. I actually met her twice. And I just learned so much from her. And when I asked her, it was... I was so caught off guard. I said to her, because, you know, my PhD is in child and adolescent development, so I say to Dr. Goodall, "Who most influenced you with your son?" Was it Dr. Spock, or who was it? She said it was Flo. And I thought, oh, my God, I can't remember that theory. Flo, what's that stand for?
It's her chimp.
Oh, God.
It's your mother.
And then
chimp.
She goes on to tell me, it's this chimp. And she watched this chimp nursing whenever the baby wanted to. And the chimp had to work. I mean, of course the chimp had to work to live, and sleeping with the baby, and just, you know, teaching and discipline and staying in close physical proximity. Not neurotic mothering. Neurotic mothering is motivated by fear. Oh, my God, don't do that. Don't do that. Attachment mothering, or bioevolutionary mothering that I refer to, is not driven by fear. It allows them to do developmentally appropriate things. And, yeah, they get in trouble. I mean, they do. They fall off stuff. They get stickers. They get, you know, their nose scraped up. But they have to do that stuff, and they have to be with us. They do. They have to form a lasting attachment, or for the rest of our lives, we're going to be wondering, what's amiss? Something's not right here. I don't feel quite safe.
Wow. Well, I know that my audience is having a little trouble with this, and that usually the audience... stable or grows, and we've lost a few people, not a lot, handful, but that doesn't usually happen. But I still think it might be one of the best and most important shows I've ever done, because if only a few people, if only one person changes their family life, could be the husband who who says to his wife, come listen to this. I just heard this. It could be a son who calls his mom and thanks her. But whatever it might be, this show could mean a great deal to a few people in a very big way. And I appreciate everybody who is listening, and it's certainly the overwhelming majority who started. I'm talking about like it's gone down like maybe 10%. And that's not what happens usually when I'm on the air, Jeannie. It's not even 10%, actually. It's just gone down a little. So I'm exaggerating. Usually it's steady or goes up. And so I hope those 5% who haven't continued listening, I hope maybe we'll have a chance to for you to hear more later, maybe. Jeannie, you're a gift to humanity. You're a gift to mothers and fathers and children and families. And I just so appreciate what you've been teaching me. It's just so incredibly important, everything you've been teaching me, because I knew next to nothing about so much of what you know so much about. It's a real gift, Jeannie. We've got about a minute and a half left. And any parting thoughts? I really want to stand here and applaud you for what you're doing and the work you're doing and your writing. And I want to keep giving you a voice.
Thank you so much. And I do know that this is controversial work. I do know that, but it shouldn't be. It shouldn't be. What kind of culture have we constructed that when Kim Kardashian walks down a red carpet with her breasts in full view, that we say, oh, that is so beautiful. And by the way, silicone-filled breasts, so beautiful. And then when a mother is nursing in church or at the synagogue, we have a fit. What kind of upside-down culture have we created? We can do better than this.
I think we can do better than this, and you're going to help us do better than this. Folks, we are made of each other from the very beginning. And there's no better illustration than today's information from Jeannie Stolzer. Just how much we're made of each other. We're made of each other's antibodies. We're made of what each other ate when they were feeding us as infants. It's just incredible. And, we come from our mother's wombs, from our mother's flesh, from our parents' genetic endowment, and then we come from the relationships we have in the first few years of life when our brain is growing at an incredibly rapid rate and being influenced by everything going on in the environment. And we're only like 12 months old and we've doubled our brain. So if you want to know the importance of relationship in the first 12 months of life, just think about that your brain is growing and growing and growing and doubling, and it's getting multiple new synapses during that period of time. Jeannie Stolzer, University of Nebraska in Kearney, spelled Kerney. Doesn't sound like Kearney to me. God bless you, Jeannie. Thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Be in touch. Bye-bye.